Ziggy Edwards grew up in Pittsburgh and earned a BA in fiction writing from the University of Pittsburgh. Her poems and short stories have appeared in publications including Confluence Paper Street, Pittsburgh City Paper, Main Street Rag, all over the place. She's been a guest on WYEP, and her first chapbook, which is quite wonderful, Hope's White Shoes, was published in 2006, and it is available for sale tonight. Please welcome our first poet of the evening, Ziggy Edwards. Thanks, Joan. Is this microphone okay? I can never really tell if it's actually picking my voice up or not. Okay, great. Wow, I'm so excited to see all these people here. That's great. It was like 10 to 8 and it was empty in here, and then this big rush of people just came in. I said, where did all these people come from? And my friend sitting over there said, they're mothers. So. Yeah, he's right. He's right. He's a philosophy major. Wow, that's really sensitive. Is this okay? Does it sound weird? Okay. Well, this is the first reading I've done in a long time. Okay, all right. And I decided it would be a lot more exciting for me if I tried to read mostly new stuff. So I'm going to give that a shot. But first, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to pimp my book. I have books for sale over there, and I'm gonna do the first one out of my book. It is $8, but I'm going to offer it tonight for the super low price of $5, because I just figured everybody here who would show up would have it, but I'm just going to stick with it anyway. Okay, so it begins. This poem is called Trigger Zen. I cocked my finger at the moon, and three pointed back. Three itchy fingers, tipped with silver crescents, linked at the knuckle. Howling would give us away. I parted the pews of my teeth, aimed at the roof of my mouth. They had grown restless under cloistered palate, firmament invisible in silence. Even the crooked and hollow rejoiced in skim light my finger let in from the clay pigeon moon. I am going to go on to something that's old and new at the same time. I'm trying to do some different stuff. So I consider this different. The North American map of cheeses. A friend and I walked into Barnes & Noble. An employee at the counter told us, yes, Patrick is working. Patrick Stewart approached us with an amused, tolerant expression. What can I do for you, ladies? We asked him to find a certain book. We had come only to hear Patrick Stewart say the name of this book. The North American Map of Cheeses, he repeated. We have that. He strode off toward the shelves. The moment he disappeared, my friend and I burst out laughing. We did this once a week. Now, I don't know. I mean, this might not be very good performance principles to do this, but I kind of feel like at a reading, when I'm at a reading, I almost get excited about the opportunity to explain what I'm doing, sort of, because if you pick up a book that has my words in it, I'm not going to be there to tell you, and I definitely don't rely on that. But that's why a reading is kind of neat to me, because I get to sort of take you behind the scenes a little bit. This poem that I just, well, it's, I mean, it's set up like a poem, but it's actually straight from a dream I had. And, I mean, it's an old one, but I've been getting more into that. So that's a lot of what I've been working with lately and kind of getting excited about. This next one is not that, but I just felt the need to. explain for some reason. This poem is about forgiveness. It's called Flagstaff. My hands open, standing behind the hill where you can't see. I hold them open in the pink thread of sunset. They catch nothing, hold nothing. But when it rains, my palms get wet. My skin absorbs. Rainwater seeps in. I receive rainwater. Open hands have their own violence. I ruin something, not everything. A summer night of movies in the park, something dumb and lighthearted. Blankets on grass again. People throw frisbees for dogs. This is good. It can't get better. Where you can't see, I hold them open. This is probably the newest one. It's called Moon in a Box. Pilots playing tic-tac-toe again, spray grids above the city. The full moon, skeletal in daylight, takes no offense at being framed here on Halkett Street. In the white desert, no one screams. Satellites show hash marks, dents over continents, like a prisoner cutting his skin. A woman in a flowered house dress sweeps her front steps. The moon and the scars deepening in twilight. This next poem is called Photographic Evidence. My friend, the junk shop owner, pulled out his iPhone saying, "Want to see something gross?" He showed a photo of his smashed fingertip, a bright red mess. "That's the bone." I gave a short laugh. "Is that real?" And didn't believe it until he stuck the phone in his pocket, held out his empty hand with one pearly nail bent over the stub. The Orderly. The man sat propped against a pillow in his hospital bed. He patted the mattress, inviting me to sit. The room was white, his gown, the sheets, sunlight filtering through the window. He took a tooth from under the pillow and showed it to me in the palm of his hand. I asked them to pull the whole thing, root and all, so they did. She's named Nicole. I nodded, not understanding. "I can't tell whether they're humoring me because I'm crazy or doing what I say because I'm rich," the man said. He touched Nicole's pointy end with the tip of his finger. "Oh, crap, that's my phone. I'll just let it go." That is so embarrassing. I'm so glad I didn't make an announcement to turn your cell phones off.
Turn your cell phones
off. Oh, man. Okay. How many times does it ring before it goes to voicemail? Hang on. I'm kind of glad that happened. That was funny. Okay, well, I'm going to go back to the last. Okay, thanks. Well, I just hope nobody calls my phone again. Okay. How much time do I have? Should I just start over with this one?
Yeah, start over.
Okay, how about that? I'll just read all. Oh, there's my voicemail. Okay. This is why I'm becoming a technophobe. Okay. The Orderly. The man sat propped against a pillow in his hospital bed. He patted the mattress, inviting me to sit. The room was white. His gown, the sheets, sunlight filtering through the window. He took a tooth from under the pillow and showed it to me in the palm of his hand. I asked them to pull the whole thing, root and all, so they did. She's named Nicole. I nodded, not understanding. I can't tell whether they're humoring me because I'm crazy or doing what I say because I'm rich, the man said. He touched Nicole's pointy end with the tip of his finger. They don't humor crazies here, I told him. You must be rich. That was worth it, wasn't it? So worth it. Okay. I'm going to pull out my book again because this is not a new one, but I just enjoy reading this. And I really don't do so many readings anymore, and I just enjoy reading this, so I'm going to read it. And it's the first poem in the book, so you don't even have to make the effort of even turning more than two pages to find this poem. It's called The Devil You Know. When Mrs. Galluli is tired of the limited vocabulary of preschool children, she drives to the public pool, where Satan is usually cooling off in the deep end. He treats her to nachos and hot dogs. He won't get cramps if he goes back in. She finds his ruminations on the president, the global economy, consumerism, quite uplifting. He rubs her pearl earring under his rough, sunburned thumb, steals her a lawn chair, then spreads a warm black towel between its arms to save her back and thighs from welts. They laugh together when the handsome, evenly tanned lifeguard slips on one of the wet wooden rungs on the way up to his throne, and he swears at his scraped hand. Yet she's never invited the devil to her third floor apartment across from the park. She finds that unwise, since he's Satan, which he's admitted from the very beginning. So, okay, this is another behind the scenes moment that I feel coming on here. when I prepare for these readings, it's kind of neat because it's like making a mixtape, that you find new ways that things go together that you've written that you never really considered before, and I had never really thought about the fact that I actually have more than one poem with the word Zen in the title. So I had to put this one in the playlist. Oh, and also, well, that'll come later. But this is a this particular poem is a hat tip to Jan Beatty in her poem Zen of Tipping. This is my poem called Zen of Tripping. And this all happened a long time ago. I feel that I have to say that. My friend Chad gave me a tab and we cut across the soccer field. It wasn't so different, except I could see beneath my bare feet and the close-cropped grass a carpet of perpendicular threads, what Earth is made from. We're all standing on a giant ball of rubber bands. Chad knew the code to an office building, so we wandered bright, empty halls. The wallpaper's relentless crisscrossing convinced me the acid had taken hold. We stepped back into the elevator without trying any doors. My parents were sleeping when I snuck in, slept through the whole night while I stood at the kitchen window, staring down my fiery reflection. By dawn, with help from the low buzz of home shopping TV, I won. Not by knowing the demon wasn't real, but by knowing it was real to anyone tripping. Oh, well, that was okay. So I saved my newest and most different thing for last. What I was going to say, I mean, it kind of similar to how I have so much fun putting these lists together of poems that I'm going to read, kind of mixing and matching. Another thing that it reminds me of is playing with those toys that they had when, probably like everybody in this room had them when they were kids, color forms. They're like those vinyl things, and you can put them on different backgrounds and stick them on things and just play little stories out because their things are characters or shapes or whatever. There are a lot of things that I do that some are really lame and I do them for work and some of them are fun and they just remind me of color forms. So I'm doing this new thing where I am taking some of my energy that I'm, and don't ask me why I do this because I don't even really know why I'm doing this, but for the past like probably more than a decade I've been writing down every dream I've ever had and recording it. So I have these archives of dreams, and I never really did much of anything with them. But I just got this idea that, well, hey, I should, like, stick my fingers in them and play with them and mix them up and it'll be like color forms. So I don't know what this is going to be called in the end, but for right now it's called color forms. Okay. Part one, basement mermaids. I wandered in my parents' basement with its blue indoor-outdoor carpeting. My dad had replaced the bookshelves with a 100-gallon aquarium. I peered in at the fish, translucent fish that resembled giant betas with red and blue patches. One of the fish hovered near the bottom of the tank. I could tell it was dead because it was transparent except for an outline, as if someone had erased everything inside. What a shame, I thought. He's always down here working on the tank and taking care of the fish, but he never can keep them alive for very long. Just then, the basement began filling with water. As the water approached waist level, it became more turbulent. A pretty girl of undetermined age appeared. She explained that she'd grown up in the aquarium as a mermaid. "So you're not going to drown?" I asked. "Oh, we're humans now. We know we can't stay." She wanted to escape with me and bring her sister. We all waded through the waves toward the stairs. Someone at the top of the stairs threw us a rope. Cheese with jail. It was a sunny day, trees lacy with leaves. Eric, Jude, and I got picked up by whitish-gray, conical, hovering things, each the size of a refrigerator. We rose far above the trees and buildings. The cones dropped us off in a lecture hall-sized room floating high in the sky. Rather than floors, it had polyester material that billowed in the wind. At the front of the room, a large window-like opening stretched along the entire wall. Everyone I knew was there. And I say air quotes because still the room wasn't crowded. Eric immediately air swam off to mingle with other people. Jude stuck around for a while, but soon did the same. I found myself somersaulting / bouncing across the billowy floor toward Jamie, Seth, and someone else who added to the incongruity of the grouping. All three grinned at each other as if they'd just stopped laughing at a hilarious joke. Michael Worcester floated near the window. He pointed behind me and said, "There's cheese here. You should try some." Long tables covered in white cloth sat normally, as they would in a room with gravity. Next to the bowl of punch and plates of cheese, a stack of napkins caught my eye. The napkins had a printed pattern, reddish-pink outlining a building with black bars across the entrance, the word jail in large black letters above the door. "Cheese with jail," Worcester chuckled. "That's what we call cheese with jail." I had to put that one in. 3, when you're lucid, you fly. I was in my parents' living room. My dad sat at the dining room table reading with the lights off. Yellowish light poured in from the kitchen doorway. I was looking aimlessly into the kitchen when it happened. I thought, hey, this is a dream. To make sure, I held up my right hand and rubbed my thumb and index finger together. I didn't feel anything. As soon as that happened, I felt myself rising to a lighter level of sleep, but fought it. I wanted to continue and see what this was like. I decided to fly because I read that's what a typical lucid dreamer does. But I didn't lift into the air. Instead, the whole scene changed to an airport tarmac. Without actually dreaming it, I'd called a friend who worked for NASA and asked him to arrange for me to ride in a space plane that looked like a cross between a helicopter and a lunar landing pod. My friend had told me I would have to ride with a gazillionaire who was very sick. He would be flown to a special hospital in Europe. Some of the gazillionaire's aides loaded him in his wheelchair into the passenger's cabin. The quadriplegic man was bald. He wore a wine-colored robe and black ascot. He kept his eyes closed and stayed still, except for occasional tremors. By this time, I boarded after them. A female voice over the loudspeaker began telling us what to do to prepare for liftoff. She got stuck at the end of one of her sentences and kept repeating, 18, 18, 18, 18. 4, it's a bat boy. I am squatting on all fours in a deep bathtub. From behind me, is anybody eating? From behind me, at the foot of the tub, Eric says, "I hate to tell you, but this time you passed a little jetter." I look down, and sure enough, all the straining has pushed a small lump of sandy textured poop onto the floor of the tub. A few grains separate from it float with the bathwater waves. I remember, or at least I'm pretty sure, this didn't happen when Jude was being born. Then again, that was different. Are you pushing? Eric asks. Oh, I forgot. I haven't felt anything this whole time. Turns out I had the baby while I wasn't paying attention. I find him floating near the drain and pick him up. No umbilical cord, but at first I don't notice. The baby is so small, no wonder I didn't know I gave birth already. I hold him in the palm of my hand. With his legs drawn up, he fits easily. He is too skinny, his limbs the size of fingers. His head is bulgy and his eyelids are bruised brown. His fingernails are also brown and pointed, each resembles a splinter. The baby looks like Bat Boy from the Weekly World News. Eventually, I realize he is not moving. He might be dead. I start poking at his rib cage, making stirring motions on his belly with my fingertip. No, no, I say, come on. It takes a while. The baby still doesn't cry, but lifts one arm to put his fingers in his mouth. He smacks on them contemplatively, eyes still closed. Look, I exclaim, isn't that cute? What do you want to name him? Eric asks. The first name that comes to mind is Benjamin, but that name is already taken. I sputter. I tell Eric I don't know, and we'll have to think about it some more. 5. Living with wild mice. I am in the basement of our house with Sharon Mama Spell. I stand in front of the washer and dryer, watching her pull on a pipe running up the wall. Mama Spell keeps one foot on the pipe as she yanks. The pipe won't budge. All her effort only covers us in dust. Every house has mice, Mama Spell says. Oh, great, I reply. That's exactly what I didn't want to hear. I tell her I was always able to get by on the assumption that my house doesn't have rodents. But now I'll be imagining them in every corner, under every piece of furniture. That's something we all have to deal with, Mama Spell says, and now we are floating above a dense field. We descend to hover over the yellow plants, and she plucks a long, reedy leaf. Everyone has mice. Thanks. That's it.